So the topic of today's lecture is shareholder value. We're in a position now to attempt to put a number on the shares of a company. And indeed, we will do exactly that in tomorrow's session when we look at the Tesco case study. I've pulled together a set of financial information about Tesco that will enable us, to work through an exercise tomorrow in the lecture that will culminate in our obtaining a number that represents the share price for Tesco. What I want to do in this lecture, by way of preparation, is make sure you're familiar with some important financial ratios. Now, what I saw yesterday in the 5 seminars that I taught is that you already are. So I guess you've met these financial ratios in the first term module, Introduction to Financial Accounting, and that's just great as far as I'm concerned. So what I've got to make sure now is what I want you to know about these financial ratios agrees with, is consistent with what you've learned last term. So let's just check that now by working through them. There are three ratios in particular, or three financial numbers I should say, that I want you to be familiar with. Earnings per share, dividend yield, and price earnings ratio. I need you to know the definition of each of them so that you can calculate them given appropriate data. But that's not enough. I also need you to have some feel for what these numbers are trying to tell you. At the end of the day, they're back of the envelope calculations. They can't possibly tell the full story. These are numbers that we work out quickly to form an idea about something. And it's that intuition that I want to help you build in the course of this lecture today. So, you might be wondering, why are we interested in these shareholder ratios in the first place? And I'd like to suggest to you, they have two distinct uses. We can use them longitudinally. What do I mean by that? I mean, we can work out the shareholder ratios for a given company at different points in its lifetime. So longitudinal means through time. But we can also use these shareholder ratios cross-sectionally. Cross-sectionally means we're at a fixed point in time and we work out these shareholder ratios for a number of different companies. So it enables us to compare different companies, e.g., in the same sector of industry. So we can make use of shareholder ratios longitudinally by fixing our attention on a particular company, but working out these shareholder ratios for that company at different points in its life and seeing how the shareholder ratio values change and seeing what story that paints about this particular company. Or quite differently, we can take a snapshot in time. We can compare different companies, typically in the same sector of industry, at the same point in time and see how they compare with one another. Which is doing best, which is doing worst, etc., etc. So two distinct uses of shareholder ratios. Now, why might you want to do this, e.g. in the case of an individual company? Well, you might be considering investing in the shares of the company. So you want to have some idea of its future prospects. You want to decide, help yourself to decide whether it's a good investment or not. But you might not be an investor. You might be a company. You might be running a company that has some other company in mind as a target. A target for an acquisition, say. In other words, a takeover. How much do you decide to pay for that company if you decide to go after it? Can I remind you, and I've said this many times, that the senior managers of your company, their key financial goal is to maximise their shareholders' wealth. If they're planning to merge or acquire another company, that had better be in their own shareholders' best interests. And one of the things they will want to be sure of is they don't end up paying too much for the target company if indeed they're successful in acquiring it. And that begs the question, what exactly are they buying if they go after a target company? And the answer is the equity of that target company. Now, by this stage in the story, you know perfectly well that companies in general are partly financed by debt and partly financed by equity. So keep in your mind the image of that box that I've used repeatedly to represent the assets of a firm, the size of the box being the market value of those assets, the market value of the firm. Think of that box as partly funded by equity, partly funded by debt. If that box represents the target firm that you're after, all you're buying is the equity piece, because it's the equity piece that confers voting rights, and therefore it's the equity piece that gives you control over that firm. When you buy a company, you're paying for the equity piece. You will typically renegotiate the debt piece with the lenders, but the lenders will continue to own the debt piece. It's the equity piece of the company that the acquiring firm is buying, and therefore it behoves the senior managers of the acquiring firm to come up with a good number, a good idea of what to pay for the equity part. In other words, what to pay for the shares of the target company. So there's a key use of being able to price shares, coming up with what you believe is a sensible number for the share price. Now, you might very well be thinking, hang on, why do you have to do that? Don't you just look in the market and see what the share price is and offer that? And the answer is no, because no target company will sell out at today's market price. Why would they do that? There's nothing in it for their shareholders. If you want to bid for the equity part of a target firm, you're going to have to offer a premium. You're going to have to offer more. There's no way that just offering to the current market price will be enough. So that begs the question, how much extra should you offer? You don't want to pay over the odds. You're going to have to include a premium in order to persuade the shareholders of the target firm to sell out. But you don't want to throw too much money at them. So being able to come up with what you think is a realistic figure for the share price, looking out into the future, that's a very important skill. And the shareholder ratios help you to do that quickly. Now, no acquiring firm is going to base their decision on these shareholder ratios. These are back-of-the-envelope calculations that you do to warm yourself up. And the acquiring firm, the senior management of the acquiring firm, they'll hire a team of advisors, and the team of advisors will carry out what's called a due diligence of the target firm. They'll take it apart. They'll go in and look in detail at its books. They will take this company apart line by line in order to come up with a value as they see it for the firm and for its equity in particular. But nonetheless, the shareholder ratios are useful to get us started, and we want to be able to do that in this module. Let's start with a number that we're familiar with. Because how many times in the seminars in particular have I mentioned the phrase market capitalization? So you should be clear. The market capitalization is another way of saying the market value of the firm's equity. Exactly what we would be interested in valuing if we have a takeover, an acquisition of another firm, the target firm, in mind. So hopefully by now you're all clear what market capitalization is. You take the number of shares outstanding, as we say, and multiply by the current market share. Now, the current market share price. The share price is going up and down every day, and indeed during the day. So the market capitalization of the firm is going up and down. It's not a fixed number. It's not like the book value of the firm's equity that you find in the balance sheet. That number is frozen at that point in time when the balance sheet was constructed. The market value of the firm's equity, the market capitalization, goes up and down each day as the share price changes. And of course, from time to time, the number of shares may also change. The company could have a rights issue, for example, which would involve it introducing additional shares into the market. The company might have a share buyback, which would involve the company in repatriating, taking back out of circulation some of the shares. So there are two reasons why the market capitalization will change. Most commonly, it's changing on a day-by-day basis because the share price is going up and down as it's buffeted by new relevant information. We've seen that the share prices typically exhibit random fluctuations. So does the market cap. But from time to time, the number of shares outstanding will also change, either increase or decrease, depending on what the company is doing. So now, by this stage in the story, every one of you knows what market capitalization means, and you know how to calculate it. You multiply the current share price by the number of shares. Now, I want to keep the focus on Tesco, because Tesco is the subject of the case study tomorrow, and also, Tesco's in the news right now. If you're following the financial news, you can't fail to realise that the chief executive of Tesco has just retired. He's been inordinately successful during his 14-year reign as chief executive, Sir Terry Leahy. Well, he's come to the end of his reign. He's handed over the reins of Tesco to another man. Let's see what he can do with it. So this is an important time in the life of Tesco. Therefore, it might surprise you when you look at the slides that are in this pack that they are all out of date. Well, that's deliberate, because I want you to do some work for yourselves outside of this lecture. I want to walk you through how I got the information and what we can learn from that information. But the information I've used in compiling these slides, this is the information I used last year at this point in the module. But this time I deliberately haven't updated my slides. In previous years, I've updated the slides to take account of what was in the most recent Tesco annual report. This year, I think we'll do something different. I'd like to invite you to do that afterwards to make sure you know where to extract the information from. And to save you some time, I've uploaded onto my.wbs a copy of the most recent annual report. Now, that's their report for 2010. So what I would like you to do at some point in the next few days is extend each of the tables that are going to appear on the next few slides. I'd like you to extend them with one new column for 2010. I've provided the 2010 annual report. I'm going to walk you through how I got the numbers from the 2009 annual report that appear in this table, and I want you to do the same for 2010. Do you have to do this? Of course you don't. If your attitude is, listen, I'm only here to get through the class test and the final exam, can we just keep it to that? Then you don't need to bother doing this. On the other hand, if you're interested in learning a bit more about finance, if you're interested in starting to cut your teeth with some tools and techniques that might be useful to you in your future career, or indeed as part of a discussion at a job interview or a placement interview, you might want to undertake this exercise. It's entirely up to you. You make of it what you want. So, we're looking at Tesco. And the first thing I want to say to you then is, what are these numbers? Well, these numbers have been taken from the annual reports over each of previous 5 years, running over the period 2005 to 2009. And what I've extracted in particular from the Tesco annual report of 2009 is the number of shares outstanding. Now, that was the number of shares at one particular point in time, on one date. So I've pulled out this. Notice how big that number is. That's 7,859 million. In other words, 7 billion, 7.859 billion shares. This is a seriously big company. This company has a huge number of shares, and the value of those shares in aggregate is massive. On that particular day, the share price was £3.332. Your market cap, so you take the number of shares and multiply by the share price, the market cap was £26.186 billion. So back in early 2009, which is when this calculation was performed, Tesco was a £26 billion organisation in terms of its equity, never mind its debt. So if you had decided as a group of people, you know, we shop enough in the local Tesco, I reckon we have a good idea about how healthy this company is. What do you say we all club together with our spare cash and we go after Tesco with a presumably hostile bid, because I suspect they won't welcome this? Well, the market value of the equity on that day was just over 26 billion, and as I said earlier, you'll have to introduce a premium to be in with a fighting chance of persuading the shareholders of Tesco. Typical bid premia for takeovers are in the region of 25%. So you have to typically offer about another 25%, another quarter. So that's in the region of about 35 billion. So if collectively you have around 35 billion floating around, then you could have put in a hostile bid for Tesco. This is a massive company. Now, can we understand where I've got some of these numbers from? Let's see what I can do with the visualizer. Well, I think we better focus it for a start, eh? So this is a particular page from the Tesco annual report, and it should look just like this. This is the 2009 Tesco annual report, and you should go look in the Tesco 2010 one. Actually, what I'm after here is information about the share price on a particular day. That date was the 28th of February 2009, because that's when the report was produced. It's actually quite difficult to find the share price of Tesco in the annual report. You've got to do a bit of detective work. And actually, where you find it is in this table, which is talking about the share options that the main directors have. And there's a footnote, would you believe it? There's a footnote to this table. Come back to me, please. Thank you. There you go. There's a footnote to the table. And at the bottom of the table, that's where you find the share price on that particular day. So that's where I've got the 333.2 pence. That's why I've highlighted that piece of information. This table, and indeed all of these tables, I've put up onto my.wbs. I've pulled them together as a document so you can see them. You can have a look. What about the number of shares? Because I need that as well in order to calculate the market capitalisation. So I've had to go to this page in the annual report, and you'll have to do the same. So I've gone to this page that's headed up Notes to the Group Financial Statements, and you'll know from your financial accounting studies last term that the notes to the annual report, that's where all the story is. So let's come down a bit. That's where I've got the number of shares. Actually, what I've got is the weighted average number of shares, and the footnotes explain exactly what that is. So there is a number that I can work with. That's where the 7.859 billion shares has come from. I've taken it from that page in the Tesco annual report. And that's what I want you to do as well in order to extend the table. Now let's just pause and let's just remind ourselves what drives share prices. What we've learned in this module is that the share price is the present value of a stream of expected future cash flows. So that's what the cartoon on this slide is reminding you about. But don't forget the matching principle. When you're aiming to value equity, both the cash flows and the discount rate you use in the calculation of present value must have to do with equity. So when you're thinking about valuing equity, or if you prefer, the price of an individual share, the cash flows you need to forecast are the dividends. If you're looking at the equity as a whole, then you're talking about the total dividend paid each year. If you're looking at the price of an individual share, then you're talking about the dividend per share. So that's what these cash flows represent. These cash flows out into the future are our best forecast today. Today is typically time zero. We don't know today how big these cash flows, these dividends per share will be. We have to forecast them. And that's a skill. That's a skill that comes with experience, that comes with doing it, sitting at the feet of men and women who've been doing it for years, from whom you learn the tricks of the trade. You don't learn the tricks of the trade from doing this module. You learn the logic of why you do it in this module, but you don't get good at doing it from doing this module. That only comes with real world experience. You should be asking yourself some other questions. You should be asking yourself when you look at this diagram, well, that's all well and good. So that's what we have to do for companies that have a track record of paying dividends. You should be asking yourself, so what do you do when the company you're looking at has never paid a dividend and isn't likely to pay a dividend in the foreseeable future? How do you get started with this method? And the answer is, these cash flows more generally are the cash flows available to be paid as dividends. The company doesn't have to pay them out as dividends. These are what we call in finance the free cash flows. In other words, they're the cash flows that are available to be paid out as dividends, but it's up to the senior management whether they do so or not. So what you have to get good at in real life, if you're interested in doing this, is you have to get good at forecasting free cash flows. And some of the techniques you'll have learned in the Introduction to Financial Accounting module help you do that. Now, the company we're looking at today and tomorrow, Tesco, has a well-established dividend track record, so I don't need to worry about this. But I want you to be persuaded that this isn't the end of the story for this approach. If the company is, e.g., a high-tech company which reinvests all of its free cash flow in itself to promote further growth, how do you possibly come up with a number for its value? Answer, you work with the cash flows available to be paid out as dividends, not necessarily paid out in fact. They could be retained. The discount rate also has to do with equity. So the discount rate you should note down is the cost of equity capital. So this equation that sits underneath the cartoon, on the left-hand side, P is today's share price. That's what we are estimating. That's what we're calculating. On the right-hand side, upstairs, are the relevant expected future cash flows. Where the company has an established track record of paying dividends, these are the expected future dividends per share. If the company has no such track record, these are the expected future free cash flows available to be paid as dividends. And downstairs is the cost of equity capital. And of course, that cost of equity capital captures how risky are the cash flows associated with the equity part of the company. And we know now, we know how risk impacts rate of return, because we've studied the capital asset pricing model. We've met the securities market line. So we've got the conversion chart for converting an amount of risk, not just any old risk, of course, the systematic component of risk, as measured by your friend and mine, beta. Once we've got an estimate of beta for the shares of this company, so once we've assessed how much systematic risk are associated with the cash flows that these shares could pay out, i.e. the dividends, or the free cash flows more generally, once we've got an estimate of that systematic risk component through beta, we can appeal to the securities market line, or equivalently, the capital asset pricing model, to come up with the value of big R. That's the cost of equity capital to use as the discount rate. And we'll see how that works tomorrow when we attack Tesco. Okay, so we've introduced market capitalization. Hopefully we're clear now. Now we carry on in pursuit of these different shareholder ratios. The first of which is earnings per share. Earnings per share belong to the shareholders. So that means where the company has debt in its capital structure, the lenders have already been fed their interest payments. It also means the tax man has been fed. Remember, any income that the company generates, once it's paid the interest on its loans, what's left is taxable. So it's taxable income. It's taxable at the corporation tax rate. What belongs to the shareholders is what's left after that. And that's what earnings per share is measuring. What's left after that, spread evenly across the total number of shares. So that's why it's saying profit after tax. After tax. So here are the numbers from Tesco. for each of those 5 years, and again, I want you to find the corresponding number for 2010. So where did I get it? I got it on the page headed up 5 year record from the annual report. So this is last year's annual report. And here is the line item. Profit for the financial year attributable to equity holders of the parent. Tesco is a group. There's the number I want. £2.161 million. Wait a minute. That's not quite what I've got in the table. Have I made a mistake? No. There's another very small, in relative terms, component to add, which is what is referred to as minority interests. So who or what are the minority interests? These are shareholders of other companies that Tesco has at some point in its history taken over. But that's the rump of the shareholders of those firms that never sold out. They held on to the shares of the company that they used to be shareholders of, and they've never caught up with the times. So the minority interests, these are minority voting interests, we have to add the earnings that are due to them. So the extra 5 combined with the 2.161 million takes the number to 2166. It wouldn't be the end of the world if you forgot about the minority interests, but if you're going to do this correctly, you should include them. We've already seen what the number of shares is. I've shown you where I've got that. So the rest of the calculation is simple division. Divide the total earnings after tax by the total number of shares. So I reckon that the earnings per share for Tesco, by my calculations, is 27.56. That's 27.56 pence. Well, I could compare that with the number that actually appears in the annual report. It's not quite right. So I'm suffering from rounding, because I've rounded the number of shares, haven't I, to the nearest million. So if we look in this part of the annual report, you see what is the published basic earnings per share in 2009, 27.50 pence. So I'm slightly out, but this calculation is correct to the level of accuracy that I'm working. But there is the earnings per share figure from the annual report. So you should be able to find that now. Dividend yield. The earnings per share is a number that accountants pay a lot of attention to. It's of less importance to finance people, because earnings, after all, are an accounting number. And they are open to, I don't want to say abuse, but they're open to manipulation. They certainly reflect accounting policy, declared earnings. Dividend yield is of more use to finance people, because dividend yield is one component of the rate of return that is required by the shareholders on their shares. The dividend yield is the income piece. The other piece of the rate of return, I hope you know by now, is the capital gain. So in general, there are two motives behind the decision of investors to buy shares in a company. They may be looking for income, i.e. from the dividends that they'll be paid, and the dividends that are paid as a percentage of the share price, that's one component, that's the income component of the rate of return. The other component is the capital gain, which they hope to achieve from seeing the share price appreciate. So then they have the opportunity, if they so wish, to sell the shares for more than they bought. So there are two components in general to owning shares. There are two components to the rate of return, I should say, the total return on owning shares. Dividend yield is one of those components. So we have to be able to calculate it. It's not difficult. You'll notice that it says net dividend per share. Dividends are taxable. Dividends are a form of income and are therefore subject to tax, to income tax. The situation, as I told you in the dividend policy lecture, the situation currently in the UK is, as far as basic rate taxpayers are concerned, there's nothing further for them to do. The company takes off the dividend tax, it's 10%, the company deducts the 10% at source. It's only higher rate taxpayers who have to pay additional tax. So this net dividend, that's the original dividend minus the taxman's 10% cut. In other words, it's calculated, the number that appears in the annual report is based on the assumption you, the shareholder, are a basic rate taxpayer. Of course, some of the shareholders will be higher rate taxpayers. That's for them to sort out with the taxman. So net means net after 10% dividend tax has been deducted. So that's how the dividend yield is calculated, and that's how the numbers turn out for Tesco. Notice that the dividend yield are percentages. They're part of the total return required by the shareholders. So in 2009, it was approximately 3.6%. So that's dividend yield. And you get the dividend from the annual report. What about price earnings ratio? This is the most useful of the three numbers for finance, because I can give you a little bit more intuition behind the price earnings ratio. There's the definition. Regardless of whether you look at things at the level of an individual share or at the equity as a whole, you can calculate the price earnings ratio either as the share price, so that's the value of one share divided by the earnings per share, or you can look at the market value of the firm's equity as a whole divided by the total earnings after tax. So we've already seen the share price. We've seen that in the 2009 annual report, the share price I extracted was 333.2 pence. We've got a figure for earnings per share we've already calculated. I'm sticking with that, but you could say to me, well, maybe it would have been more sensible to use the figure that you extracted from the annual report. So you could, if you want, change that to 27.50. I don't mind. The PE ratio is the ratio of the two, 12.09. The question is what to make of that ratio. Now remember, we're more than a year out of date, because I'm using information that I found in the 2009 annual report. You can now do the same sort of calculations using the 2010 annual report, and you won't have to wait terribly long before we get the next annual report coming out. So the information is somewhat out of date. The question is, what to make of that PE ratio that we've calculated? Well, one thing we can do is compare the PE ratio of Tesco. Now, I calculated it at that point in time. I made it 12.09. On any day, any trading day, you can look in the Financial Times. The information in the Financial Times refers to the story at the end of the previous trading day. So you can find the PE ratio for Tesco. The question is, what do you make of that number? Well, one thing you can do with that number is compare it with the PE ratio for other companies in the same sector. So that would be using it cross-sectionally. So you could look up Sainsbury, you could look up Asda, you could look up Morrison's and see how the PE ratios compare. You could take a step back and compare Tesco's PE ratio with the sector in which Tesco trades. It's actually known as the food and drug retailing sector. And so there's a PE ratio for that sector. Now what I've done here, and again, this is a year out of date, and I want you to go and update it, and I'm going to show you in a minute where to get these numbers. But looking back a year, to be consistent with the annual report I used in the numbers earlier, in the earlier slides, on this particular day in 2010, the Tesco PE ratio was 17.9. I took that from the newspaper. The corresponding PE ratio for the sector as a whole was a little bit lower. So Tesco has a slightly higher PE ratio than its overall sector, and a significantly higher PE ratio compared to the companies that make up the FTSE 100. So the question is, how do we interpret this? The price earnings ratio is what it says on the tin. It's the price, the share price, divided by the earnings per share. You might have been encouraged in your financial accounting lectures to think of that number, because that's what it is, it's a number, it's a multiple, to think of it in terms of how many years would it take Tesco shares to pay back the share price, today's share price. Given the current level of earnings per share, how many periods out into the future would you have to reproduce those earnings per share in order for them to stack up and add up to today's share price? Now, that's how an accountant would look at that number. And that's not a stupid thing to do. In finance, we're definitely looking out into the future, and we think of the price, the share price, as the crystallization. It's those expected future cash flows, admittedly discounted back to the present day to take into account time value of money, but that share price is capturing in a single number what we currently believe about Tesco shares' ability to generate cash flow, dividends in particular, out into the long-term future. What I hope you're starting to think is, I think this may have something to do with growth. And the PE ratio is a simple proxy for growth. So, when I look at a particular company, e.g. Tesco, at different points in its lifetime, and I compare its price-to-earnings ratio at those different points, I might be able to say something about its growth rate or its growth potential at different points in its life. More usefully, when I fix on a particular point in time, say right now, and I calculate the price-earnings ratio for Tesco, for Sainsbury, for Asda, for Morrisons, etc., and I compare them, I can say something about the relative growth rates. So the message I could take away from the numbers on this slide is that Tesco would appear to be doing a bit better than the sector as a whole. Now, we mustn't push it too far, because at the end of the day, it's only a single number. And inevitably, when we try to compress what is a complicated story into a single number, we run into the difficulty, we might be reading too much into the number. So what I want you to appreciate, and you'll learn more about this next year, is what lies behind the price-earnings ratio. The PE ratio is a proxy for growth, I've said that. But there are a number of considerations that impact the price-earnings ratio. That number downstairs is bothering me. It's bothering me because it's an accounting number. And that begs the question about the quality of that number. Now, what do I mean by the quality? I mean, how repeatable is it? How reproducible is it? How much faith can I have in that earnings per share number? Because at the end of the day, the number that sits above it, the share price, is saying something about what we believe is true about the company's ability to generate cash flows out into the long-term future. But the number that's sitting downstairs is an accounting number that refers to the accounting period that has just ended. Maybe that period was affected by special events. Maybe it was an exceptional year for Tesco. Maybe as a result of that, those exceptional events, maybe the earnings per share figure is either too big or too low. So we might want to worry about, should we adjust the earnings per share to take out this exceptional event or events before we start to read too much into the price-earnings ratio. The other thing we've got to worry about with a price-earnings ratio is the effect of inflation. Inflation is starting to come back into the story. It's been largely silent in recent years, thanks to the good work of the Monetary Policy Committee. And you should know from the first online group discussion, and what you may have read up about the Monetary Policy Committee, that the reason they're there on this planet is to ensure price stability. That's their remit. Ensure price stability. Keep the inflation rate, as measured by the Consumer Prices Index, the annual rate of increase in the Consumer Prices Index, keep that within 1%, 1% on either side of the target figure of 2%. Now, as you've read the articles in the FT that I gave you, you can't be under any illusion. They're not doing that well at the moment. They're not doing that well at maintaining price stability. The CPI inflation rate has gone way above the 3%. It's broken through the upper limit. So inflation is starting to come back, and you should know from your financial accounting lectures how inflation impacts earnings, how inflation impacts accounting numbers. So that raises a doubt about what we call the quality of the earnings figure. And of course there's risk. Wait a minute, you're thinking, where is the risk in the price-earnings ratio? The risk is inside P. The price-earnings ratio is today's share price divided by the reported earnings per share figure. But today's share price, we know, is the present value of the expected future cash flows. Present value involves discounting those expected future cash flow forecasts, dividends per share if you like, back to the present day, using the correct risk-adjusted discount rate. So risk impacts price-earnings ratio. Another thing you'll learn next year when you go on and do finance too is the gearing ratio of the company impacts price-to-earnings ratio. Why? Because the gearing ratio impacts what we call financial risk. And if you think back to the little Mickey Mouse calculation we had in the lecture on capital structure, where I compared two firms, they were identical in terms of their business activities and their business risk. Depending on whether we were in the good times or the not so good times, their operating cash flows varied in exactly the same way. They had identical operating cash flows. The risk could have been measured by the 20% drop in the operating cash flow from the good times to the not so good times for each of the two firms. But when we looked down the table at the story from the point of view of the shareholders, we saw that the shareholders of the geared firm were exposed to twice as much risk as the shareholders of the ungeared firm. So there was an additional component of risk, we call that financial risk, that was there because that geared firm was partly financed by debt. So the gearing ratio impacts the financial risk and therefore the price-earnings ratio. I just want to finish by showing you where do you get these numbers from the FT. Now hopefully this is still alive. There we go. So this is page 34 in today's FT. And we are looking for Tesco. So I need to find retailers. So where is retailers? Retailers are down here, but actually Tesco, coming quite late in the alphabet, is back up here, I think. So let's open up that box a little bit. Can we see that? Right, that's not looking too bad. There we go. And let's scroll over here a bit. So what I've opened up here is part of the financial data from today's FT, so it refers to yesterday. We're looking at the retailer sector, the food and drug retailers. Here is our friendly company Tesco, and this column, you can't see the heading because I'll have to scroll back up, this number here in this column is the Tesco price earnings ratio. So that's where you find the PE ratio for Tesco. What about the different sectors in the market as a whole? Let's go down to here, FTSE Actuaries Share Indices, and let's open up this table. And there you see any number of FTSE indices. And look at the different information you can find about, e.g., the companies that together make up the FTSE 100, and in particular, the PE ratio. So whereas Tesco was coming in with a PE ratio of about 14, the companies that make up the FTSE as a whole are coming in with a number slightly below 11.5. So the suggestion there is that Tesco, all other things being equal, Tesco is exhibiting considerably more growth than the companies that make up the FTSE as a whole. I wonder why that might be. I wonder what companies are making up the FTSE 100. Well, the biggest 10 companies make up the lion's share of the FTSE 100. And you might want to ask yourself, what sort of companies are they? Might they, e.g., be some of the largest banks in the world who maybe have had difficult times in the last couple of years thanks to the credit crunch?